Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Greeny. Mike Greenberg brings his unmatched depth of sports knowledge weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. Listen to Greeny as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, don't miss the biggest rematch at UFC 260 as heavyweight champion Stipe Miocic and number one contender Francis Ngannou meet for the second time. UFC 260 on March 27th is exclusively available to ESPN Plus subscribers for $69.99. Visit ESPN Plus/PPV. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about some nonsense that's going on at the NCAA tournament. We got some stories from you guys about getting big checks and doing dumb things with them. But first... Oh, man, Gabe, the last week was not good for the NBA as it relates to injuries. LaMelo Ball, who seemed to be running away with Rookie of the Year, he has broken his wrist. He probably will not play for the rest of the season. And LeBron James has a high ankle sprain that has him out indefinitely, right? Which tells me that it's probably going to be over a month, probably closer to 6 weeks. Like, the high ankle sprain can get you into that world. But if they really thought that this was a 2 or 3 week high ankle sprain, they would have told us that this was going to be a 2 or 3 week high ankle sprain. Instead, the Lakers, who are not built to lose LeBron, they weren't really built to lose Anthony Davis. Now they're going to be down both of them. Gabe, it's going to be like real anonymous out there for your squad on the floor without LeBron.
Real anonymous. Are we not giving credit to Kyle Kuzma and Alex Caruso?
Why'd you have to bring Caruso in? Like, that's all I'm saying, right? Like, how did Caruso wind up being the number two? Is he really the next best player on the team? You ain't talking about Trez. You ain't go there. Y'all got a new initial guy. You ain't want to talk about that.
A new initial guy? You're talking about Horton Tucker?
That the THT guy?
Yeah, he really needs to be able to show what he can do at the center of the offense now.
Ah, yes, THT. I'm dynamite. THT has no idea what that joke is. I don't even know if you know what that joke is. But I'll say, you know, did AC/DC make it down to your generation?
That saying did, and the T-shirts did, right?
THT. Man, so a couple things on this with the Lakers. The Lakers are built to orbit around LeBron James. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the fact of the matter, that you take LeBron out of this equation. I don't know how this thing is supposed to work. I also don't really know how much it matters in terms of how it's supposed to work without LeBron there. Because this is where we start talking about, like, the regular season in the NBA doesn't matter. And that's not really true. Like, the regular season typically gives us a good indication of who the best teams are and so forth and so on, right? Where the regular season doesn't matter, and I think becomes problematic for the NBA in terms of holding up people's interest in the regular season, is that where a team is ultimately seeded based upon its record doesn't really matter that much. So what I mean by that is, if the Lakers go into the playoffs as a 4 seed, I don't think we're really looking at it from the Lakers as like, damn, I don't know if you guys can do it coming all the way down from a 4 seed. It's like the NFL, for example. Regular season stuff matters because home field really matters, because it's a single elimination tournament that they have. You know what I mean? So, like, where you wind up being seeded matters because of where you ultimately have to go, or there might be a bye week or whatever it is. But the Lakers team in the last decade, when they won all those championships, right? I guess not even the last decade anymore, the one before that. The one where they won all those championships. If you were to ask most people which was the best of those Lakers teams, most of them would tell you that it was the 2001 team. That's the team that went in the playoffs and they only lost one regular season game, right? That's the one we would say. Okay. That team won 56 games that year. The year before, they won 67. The year before. That year, the Lakers, they did win the Pacific Division at 56 wins. They were the second seed behind the Spurs. When they blew the Spurs off the floor in the Western Conference Finals that year, they did not have home court advantage. It didn't matter. Nobody cared. Right? Like, that's the problem that the NBA has in terms of getting people interested in the regular season, is that nobody cares where those teams wind up seeded. So if the Lakers were to wind up like the sixth seed, I find that to be unlikely, but it's not terribly implausible considering how bunched up all those teams are in the West. If the Lakers wind up at the sixth, nobody cares. The Lakers are still in the playoffs, right? So if they get LeBron and they get Anthony Davis back in time to kind of round into form by the time we get into the postseason, then it doesn't really matter that LeBron missed all this time unless you think that the Lakers are going to wind up in a place where they're not going to make the playoffs. And I don't think that's going to wind up being the case. I wouldn't care if they wound up being the eight. If they wound up being eight, the biggest loser is Utah, because then they'd have to mess around and play the Lakers at the eight. And in fact, this is where I would say it matters. The regular season matters, and where your seeding goes matters for a team like Utah. But the reason it matters for Utah is not really so much about where the matchups are and how they proceed, but it's an accomplishment for Utah to get the number one seed. Like, that is a way of looking at them and seeing like, oh man, these guys took a leap. These guys are now here. You know, that's where it goes. For the Lakers, though, doesn't really matter. Get the guys back when you get them back. Figure it out. Boom, you go from there. And I kind of dig, like, people are like, man, the problem with LeBron is the team is always built around LeBron, and LeBron's not there, then the team can't work. Well, I got news for you. If LeBron ain't on the team, y'all won't go win nothing anyway. Therefore, that part doesn't really matter. He does kind of have the Dr. Dre, Bill Belichick thing going, though, in terms of putting, like, who the players are around them and how that works. Have I told you my thought on how Bill Belichick and Dr. Dre are kind of the same? All right, so through time, Dr. Dre has done a lot of work with a lot of people who could never really figure out how to make it happen unless they were working with Dr. Dre, right? Eazy-E is actually a great example of this. Eazy-E ain't really had no heat if he was not working with Dr. Dre. MC Ren, I think, might be one of the most underrated rappers that's ever been. The heat wasn't never really there without Dr. Dre. You fast forward to like the 2001 album, that dude Hitman. Hitman was the dude all over that joint. We're like, man, Hitman gonna blow up. We ain't heard from Hitman since, right? Because the only dude that can really figure out how to make that Hitman thing work is Dr. Dre. And through years, he stays picking up more dudes. And part of it is because Dr. Dre, you know, don't be messing around and putting people shit out. But, you know, after that happens, Dr. Dre figures out how to work with these dudes, but nobody else can figure it out. And he's not trying to figure out how to make them like the greatest rappers of all time. He's just trying to figure out how to make them work on his tracks. Bill Belichick, the same way. Bill Belichick was out here winning Super Bowls with all these dudes that you never heard of, and then somebody go out there and sign one of those Patriots players, and other than like Chandler Jones, ain't none of them turn out to be worth a damn going out here working with nobody else, right? Bill Belichick figures out who are the guys are that can work in the thing that he does, and he is not worried about anything else. Kind of same with LeBron and these dudes that he winds up playing with. Now, Anthony Davis, of course, is not an example of that. Even, I'd say, Montrezl Harrell, probably not an example of that. But they built that team around the vision of the producer, and the producer is LeBron. And when the producer is gone, nobody can figure out how to get these dudes to rap. Nobody can figure out what the beat is that these cats need to be on. Only LeBron's the dude that can get that right. But again, if LeBron's not there, they wouldn't win in nothing anyway. The Clippers, they can play without Kawhi Leonard, but if Kawhi Leonard ain't there, it ain't about to happen. It ain't about to crack. It's not going to be what it is. But the guess is LeBron will be back, and then we'll see how they look rounding into shape going into the playoffs, right? And who knows? Maybe it'll make the playoffs more interesting because we'll have some better first-round matchups, because if the Lakers fall down in the seedings, they'll be playing against some heavy hitters to start with. You'd rather watch them play, say, I don't know, the Nuggets in the first round. Then you would want to see them play, you know, whoever's at the bottom of the West right now. Like, that's kind of the way that I see it.
Was there a Cavs team that LeBron was on that entered the playoffs as a really low seed?
No, they were pretty high because the rest of the East was boo-boo too, you know. So they'd be in there around that 50-win mark, and so they'd still be there. And they remember when he was in Cleveland the first go-around, they had them 2 years where they had the best record in the East, winning like 60, you know, 66 games and stuff like that. And then couldn't figure it out. When they got to the end, because the regular season is such a different animal. But I'm telling you now, though, if there's a bright side to the fact that LeBron is not going to be playing for a little while, is that we don't have to keep having this LeBron for MVP discussion. Kind of glad that one's over, except if the Lakers get out here and stink without LeBron, then the LeBron for MVP conversation will not be over because people will then use that as the indicator that LeBron James is actually the MVP. Gabe, I don't know if you saw this the other day online. I was trying to talk about this with people, and people got mad at me, okay? Because we're at this point now where people are trying to make the argument that LeBron should have something like 8 MVPs. Like Kyle Kuzma said that. LeBron has not won an MVP in 8 years. And the argument is being put out there that he should have won all these more MVPs than he has up until this point. It's a very similar thing to when Kobe Bryant was around and people were like, I can't understand how it is that Kobe Bryant only won one MVP. Shaquille O'Neal is in the same place. I can't understand how he only won one MVP. You know who else only has one MVP? Kevin Durant. Like, Kevin Durant only has one MVP. Hakeem Olajuwon only has one MVP. David Robinson only has one MVP. And as people say LeBron should have had 8 MVPs, Michael Jordan has 5. Now, I could make an argument about one or two other ones that maybe Jordan should have won. But this 8 MVP thing, dude, that's not how this league works. Now, part of it with this league, of course, is they get tired of giving you MVPs. No one has won 3 MVPs in a row since Larry Bird from 84 to 86. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar never won 3 straight MVPs. I guess if you go back to like Wilton Russell, I haven't gone back there, but this league generally just doesn't give guys 3 straight MVPs. They game LeBron out of that MVP in 2011 that he should have won with the Heat just because everybody hated him so much at that time. But LeBron's MVP count is about where it should be. And when you look year after year since he won his last MVP, I don't have a year that I can point to and say that LeBron James should have been the MVP. In 2014, Kevin Durant should have won the MVP. In 2015 and 16, there's no question, Steph Curry should have won the MVP. 2017, they gave it to Russell Westbrook, and there's a host of other people that you could have given it to, but probably not him. 2018, James Harden won MVP. And I think that it was legit that James Harden won the MVP. 19 and 20 was Giannis. He was the guy that should have won the MVP in those years. Now, in that intervening time period that we're talking about, one thing we can't forget is that LeBron told the world, I don't care about the regular season anymore. It's not that big a deal. I'm trying to get championships. At this point in my career, I'm not worried about MVPs. And now all of a sudden, LeBron worried about MVPs. Now, see, what LeBron figured out about the MVP game, though, is the MVP game is a little bit about performance, but almost entirely about narrative. What story we cook up and win is who gets the MVP. And so what LeBron is doing, he the tail wagging the dog this go around. He got out here and started talking about how he hadn't won the MVP since whenever. And then all of a sudden, everybody gets on TV and starts carrying the water about, damn, yeah, LeBron should have won that MVP. And if people start saying it enough, then you go make LeBron into MVP. Now, it's going to be hard to pull off with the course of these injuries, right? But the bottom line is this. I am not, and Gabe, you know this about me. I am not like wedded to advanced statistics. I am not a person that strictly uses advanced statistics as the way to evaluate how good a player is or is not, right? Like there's things that your eyes matter and everything else. Like that's the thing. And so the thing with LeBron is we don't think collectively that any player impacts winning like LeBron James does. And you know, when you watch it, you feel it. Like having him out there impacts whether or not his team is going to win, it feels like more than anybody else, right? Got it, 100%. There's something to that. But as a regular season performer, he's probably top 10 this year, but he's not number one. The two best players so far this season, and when I say they're the best players so far this season, I'm not saying they're the best players in the world, but I'm saying they are playing better this season than anybody else. It's been Nikola Jokic and Joel Embiid. Those have been the top two guys. I don't even necessarily know if it's close. And with Jokic, hey man, let me put something into context for you about Jokic. Now, I've been going through and looking at numbers and looking at data and trying to find things, advanced numbers that, you know, really correlate to who's going to win the MVP. And the statistic that I have found that is most strongly correlated to winning the MVP is win shares per 48 minutes. Like, that is the one where the eye test tends to line up with the numbers about who the best player is in the league. And since 2007, there have only been three players who led the league in win shares per 48 minutes who did not win the MVP. One was Chris Paul in 2008 when Kobe got his lifetime achievement MVP. When everybody looked up, it was like, damn, Kobe ain't never won MVP. And then the Lakers had the best record in the West. After Kobe had asked to be traded, all that stuff, right? Boom. So we had that one. 2011, Derrick Rose wasn't even close to the top, really, at win shares per 48 that year. LeBron James was that guy. And we've talked already about why it is that LeBron James did not win that MVP. And then the most recent was in 2017, when it was Russell Westbrook. And off the top of my head, I can't remember who led in win shares per 48, but Westbrook was way far down. But again, that was a narrative-based MVP. That was Kevin Durant has left, Russell Westbrook has averaged a triple-double. And he was really, really good, and I would have been inclined to vote for him as MVP that year too. But you see what I'm saying there, all right? Nikola Jokic win shares per 48 minutes this year, the statistic that we're talking about, is at a 0.31 the last time I checked, okay? My man Ryan Blackburn, who covers the Nuggets for the SB Nation site over there, he lists this stat. He says there have been 10 seasons in NBA history with the win shares per 48 minutes higher than 0.300. Wilt in 1964, Kareem in 1971, Kareem in 1972, Kareem in 1973, Jordan in 88, Jordan in 91, Jordan in 96, LeBron in 09, LeBron in 13, Curry in 16. All of those players won the MVP except for Kareem in 73. And what did we just talk about? They don't like giving the MVP to somebody 3 years in a row. He won it the 2 years before, right? And in 1964, my fault, Wilt did not get it because Oscar Robertson won the MVP that year, basically because he averaged a triple-double. 31 points, 9.9 rebounds, 11 assists. Wilt Chamberlain was right there behind him because this was a year where they decided they weren't going to give the MVP to Wilt Chamberlain. That's what you got. Jokic is playing not just MVP caliber basketball. Jokic is playing all-time great caliber of basketball this year. I understand all the reasons why people are not inclined to look at him as an MVP, in large part because of the perception that he doesn't play defense. And he doesn't play great defense. He's there, but he's leading the league in steals, for whatever that's worth, right? Like, he's not just totally useless on the other side of the ball. But he don't seem like the guy that people want to make the MVP. Embiid, probably the best defensive player of the year in the league this year, and has become like a different caliber of offensive player. Now, he's missed so many games that he might not wind up winning the MVP. But LeBron's not in the same place as those dudes. Kawhi Leonard is playing better this year than LeBron is. Giannis is playing better than LeBron is. And people are saying, well, the Lakers, you know, he's averaging 25, 8, and 8. Those numbers don't mean the same thing that they used to. Luka Doncic is averaging those kinds of numbers. And Luka Doncic ain't no damn MVP in spite of how hard people tried to give him the damn MVP before the season started. Like, he just hasn't been that guy. What Lakers fans will tell you is, well, LeBron is playing first team all defense caliber defense this year. And I guess, if you say so, because I remember when LeBron was a first team all defense player, and it looked a lot different than this. Like, LeBron is first team all defense player, could guard Pau Gasol and Derrick Rose on back-to-back nights. That ain't the dude that he is at this point. And that's fine. At his age, like, dudes really stop playing that super high caliber defense once they get into their late 20s. That's pretty much across the board how that goes. They might still make some all defense teams later that on the basis of reputation, but they stop playing that level of defense as their careers move. That's what it is. He ain't the MVP this year. He wouldn't have been the MVP this year if he had kept playing. I just couldn't figure out why people were so mad at me about it. Like, people hit me up. See, that's it. Bomani don't know nothing about basketball. See, that's Bomani being a casual. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. You, LeBron, should win 8 MVPs and is the MVP this year. No, that's not something a casual fan would say. Yeah, you went deep in your bag and your analysis and your research to come up with LeBron as the MVP. You got to know everything about basketball to get to the bottom of that one and figure that out. The hell are you talking about, man? Like, it's so wild that Lakers fans spend so much time hating on LeBron all those years, and then he gets with the Lakers, and then all of a sudden they're like, okay, so we're going to treat him like it's Kobe. We're not going to listen to anything anybody actually says. We're not really going to think about this. And if you don't like it, you're just a Laker hater. I'm like, when the hell did I start hating the Lakers? Like, Gabe, you root for the Lakers. You know, you could tell them. If I hated the Lakers, you would know. I used to really like the Lakers. Like, I don't get into anybody like that anymore because I do this job now. Like, this job kind of throws you off on it. But I ain't got no beef with LeBron. LeBron just not the MVP. Like, I ain't had no beef with LeBron this summer. He just not Muhammad Ali. All these things can happen. Like, it's almost like at this point, there's no room for any level of nuance on this. But what I'm not about to do is let LeBron tell us that we gonna make him the MVP. That's what's not about to go down. You not about to let him determine that he's the MVP. Remember last year they won the championship? I want my damn respect. Yeah, because don't nobody respect you, LeBron. Like, every day I look around and I just wonder, when's somebody going to say something nice about LeBron? Don't y'all know he good? How come y'all don't be saying nothing nice about LeBron? Nah, LeBron, it ain't happening. I'm not going for this. There are lots of other players this year who have played as well, if not better than LeBron, and there are players who have definitively played better than LeBron James has played this year. But Lakers going to come out here and not be good, and then what they going to flip it to? Because at first, Embiid can't win it. He missed too many games.
But you see what they're doing without LeBron? See? They ain't no good.
I just want him to come back because I enjoy watching LeBron playing basketball, and I'd much rather hear y'all talk about him playing than y'all talk about what happens when he don't. The NCAA tournament is going. I have watched some of it. Cade Cunningham just got eliminated, which took out a lot of the interest that I was going to have. And that was bad for the NBA. That was bad for the NCAA because I thought that him getting to the Sweet 16 was going to wind up being a showcase that really all of basketball needed. Because one thing about this college basketball season is, like, I feel like it's a if you know, you know kind of situation with Cunningham. But this season has not made him into a star in the way that, like, Zion Williamson became a star. Now, part of it, of course, is that Cunningham went to Oklahoma State and not Duke. But when you talk to people in college basketball, they talk about Cunningham in the ways that they talk about players through the years where even if you didn't watch college basketball, you were aware of who that person was. And so I thought they just needed to get him on a big stage. But Oregon State, which has not been good since I was 9 years old, literally since I was 9 years old, got to cracking, made it happen, right? Got themselves to the Sweet 16. Good for y'all. At the expense of a team that we actually wanted to watch play. NCAA got, what you call them? Illinois out of there. They matched them up against Loyola in one of the made-for-TV games. Illinois should have won that game, right? They're a better team. They should have won it. But still, they caught a team that they shouldn't have been there to play because the NCAA got to get this money, man. They got to get everything they can out of this tournament. Like, people are like, yo, you think they're going to have an NCAA tournament this year? They will have a tournament called the NCAA tournament. If the three of us or all of us working on this show had to get two more people to enter into it, it'd have been like, hoop it up. But whatever it is, they would have put us in the NCAA tournament because there was going to be a damn tournament no matter what, period. All right? So, tournament is going. But what I want to talk about here is what came to light about the imbalance between the accommodations between what the players at the men's tournament were receiving in terms of like gift bag type stuff and just accommodations versus the women's tournament. Because pictures started showing up online of the women pointing out how inadequate their weight room was, for example, compared to the men. The swag bags that they got, how they were not up to snuff in comparison to what the men received. And a lot of people have pointed to the idea, well, of course the men get those things because the men's tournament makes more money. That would hold water if it wasn't obvious disingenuous bull. And this is what I mean when I say that or why I put it in that way. The comparison that I would actually like to see between like these sorts of accommodations under these circumstances is not so much comparing the men's tournament to the women's tournament. I would like to see how this would compare like women's basketball versus say what kind of accommodations are there for the water polo Final Four or whatever they do, you know, tournament or the men's golf tournament. Like I want to see how this compares to men's sports that are non-revenue. because I got a feeling that those men's sports would be in a place where they would have better accommodations than the women had for this tournament. Like, I do not think that this is being done purely as a function of revenue. I think that this is being done because they just do less for women. Like, hard stop. Like, that's what I think it comes down to, that they just do less for women when they are in a position where they could certainly do more. And what got me about this was, y'all ain't got nobody in the room with the power to make decisions, to look around at what y'all was doing, to be like, guys, this isn't going to look good if somebody puts it on Instagram. Like, there wasn't one person that could foresee what a public relations disaster this would be. Like, Mark Emmert had to get out there and say, no, this is indefensible. You know, this isn't right. It shouldn't be this way and all this stuff. Nobody thought about that on the front end. Like, when you were trying to figure out what it was that you needed to have in place in order to bubble, because they're basically effectively bubbling the players in the cities that they're in. The women are in San Antonio. The men are in Indianapolis. Nobody was there to tell you, nah, I think you're going to need to do better than that. Right? Because correct me if I'm wrong, we didn't have any of these stories about the wubble this year where they were at IMG in Florida for the WNBA, you know, when they did their bubble versus what was going on in the NBA bubble. Now, I'm sure that the NBA bubble had some things going for it that the women did not. Like, I'm positive of that. But nothing to the point where the women felt the need to speak on it, right? And we know that those women will speak on it if they feel like they have to. Because somebody over there looked around and was like, yo, we can't be out here doing this, you know, in this imbalanced sort of way. But that's what they did here. Beyond them being dumb, Sally Jenkins wrote a column for the Washington Post about this. She put out some details about the differences between the ways that men and women are treated by the NCAA, just in terms of basketball, that actually shocked me. Like, check this part out. The women's Final Four is an annual sellout, and ESPN paid $500 million for a TV contract, bundling the tournament with 24 championships. You know how much money UConn, Stanford, or Baylor will get for winning the women's tournament? Nothing. The NCAA provides no payouts to women at all. It refuses to factor the women into any revenue sharing. Okay, so you could say that the men's tournament makes more money, but you cannot say that the women's tournament does not make money. And the way the revenue sharing typically works is your conference gets a unit for every game a team in your conference wins. So the West Coast Conference with Gonzaga, for example, if Gonzaga wins six games in the tournament, then they get six units, each unit being some amount of money, back to the conference. And then the conference then distributes the revenue that is earned there.
It's a lot of money, too.
Yeah, yeah. It is literally saying, though, that what the women do doesn't matter. Like, if you're saying that you're not going to share any revenue on the basis of women winning and doing well, you're just saying they don't matter. They don't get any payout in that way. I had no idea of this until I read this column. Listen to this. And this is what I think, like, you know, the stuff like the weight room and stuff, yeah, that's kind of messed up. This is another thing from Sally Jenkins' column. She says, exactly where does the NCAA, which calls itself a nonprofit and benefits from all manners of preferential subsidies, deductions, and tax favors on its billions in TV and licensing revenue, get off pretending the women's tournament has no value at all? And where does it get off serving the athlete slop? And why are they giving women a combination of antigen and PCR tests for COVID-19 while the men only undergo the more expensive and more reliable PCR testing? All right. So, what are they doing here? They are providing women lesser testing. Like, what it sounds like they're doing with the women's tournament is that they're using the antigen test first, and then if the antigen test comes in inconclusive or comes up positive, then they go to the real test because they try to make those real tests stretch. You could very easily do that same thing with the men's tournament. There's nothing stopping you from doing the same thing with the men's tournament, except it's not as safe, so they're not doing it. And that's what they're doing with the women's tournament. Look, man, this is indefensible, but the part that gets me, like, when I look at it and when I think about it is, for lack of a better term right now, that's just hating women. Like, that's just the idea that they know that they're not supposed to do as well by women as they do by men. It don't feel right. It's not the natural order of events. And it's preposterous that they would engage in this way. It is preposterous that these women will ultimately wind up being treated as they are on the basics, like the basic fundamental things that are necessary in order to keep this whole thing going. Nope, 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 nope. They're not doing that. They're not doing that. And so please check out Sally's column because I thought it was really good. And it has a whole lot of just different things about the imbalances and inequities and things that women have dealt with on that level of just the NCAA, it feels like, provides sporting opportunities for women because they have to. And then since they have to, they are not inclined to provide anything more than absolutely necessary in order to make it happen. And as much as I have the problems with not paying athletes and everything else, like all that stuff that goes up and down, that's fine, right? This, to me, is as indefensible as anything else that is related to all the other things that we talked about with the NCAA, because they could do better here. It would not be that hard for them to do better. They had time to do better, and they ultimately knew that this would be exposed before the world. And they looked at these women and honestly said, as Sally put in her column, you're not worth as much as them. But that worth is not about money worth to me. It is a much more intangible concept of value. It is like human value. They got the money. They can make it work. They chose not to. And they chose not to because those are women. Hard stop.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
Today's If You Haven't Heard difference-making stories brought to you by CarMax. Don't just buy a car. Love your car with the new CarMax Love Your Car Guarantee.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from entertainment.
This is Jay Coyle. I'm a film writer and critic for the Associated Press. For years, researchers have said a lack of diversity in Hollywood films doesn't just poorly reflect demographics, it's bad business. A new study by the consulting firm McKinsey & Company estimates just how much Hollywood is leaving on the table. $10 billion. The McKinsey report analyzes how inequality shapes the industry and how much it ultimately costs its bottom line. The consulting firm deduced that the film and TV industry loses 7% or $10 billion every year by undervaluing black films, filmmakers, and executives. The study's authors write, "Fewer black-led stories get told, and when they are, these projects have been consistently underfunded and undervalued, despite often earning higher relative returns than other properties." The study spans the years 2015 to 2019 and was conducted over the last 6 months, drawing from earlier academic research. But the lack of black representation in top positions of power plays a prominent role. The study found that 92% of film executives are white. In TV, it's 87%. At the top three talent agencies, agents and executives are 90% white. Among partners, it's 97%. Researchers found that films with a black lead or co-lead are budgeted 24% less than movies that don't, a disparity that nearly doubles when there are two or more black people working as director, producer, or writer. The film business, the consulting firm said, is less diverse than industries like energy, finance, and transport.
Less diverse than finance! Than finance! But this is in line with what we were just talking about with the tournament. Black projects don't get the same funding, and it's not related to how they perform. It's just because they're black people, and you're not supposed to do right by black people. You can do well at the margins that are given to you. That ain't gonna be what it is. Like many years ago, I did an interview with Ice Cube, and I was talking about movies, and he was just talking about, look, you know, part of why we were able to get these movies made is because we walked in and we were like, look, this $3 million script. They're like, oh yeah, we're willing to do a $3 million script. And then they turn a $3 million script into $30 million at the box office or whatever, and they get the boom. But that don't make the man come tell you, you did so well with that $3 million, we're going to give you $20 million. No. In response, they're like, yo, you are the master at the $3 million script. Yo, can't nobody make $3 million flip like you can make $3 million flip. Here's another $3 million. And that's how they do. That's what the game winds up being. So I always talk about how you can't achieve your way out of racism. That's the bottom line right there. Like, they just don't, like wage gap type stuff, right? They just don't like to pay us. They just don't feel like paying black people. They don't feel like paying women. They don't feel like paying Latinos. They just don't feel like giving us none of the money that they think is theirs, even if you out here making more money for them. Like, look, McKinsey did the study. McKinsey. That ain't the Urban League. That ain't the NAACP. That's McKinsey. I think their whole business game is kind of evil. And they're like, yo, you know, you could probably make some more money off these black people. Because McKinsey, they don't have no hearts. They don't have no souls. They just like, yo, go get this money. And they over here like, you know, they're black, right? Like, why would we do that? Yo, it's just bananas.
This next story comes from Tech.
This is Brian Barrett from Wired. For years, Netflix has let you share your password with basically as many people as you want. This month, though, it started testing ways to crack down.
Making some users put in a special code before they're able to watch. If you're not the person with the phone number or the email address that's associated with the account, you're out of luck. Netflix says this is a limited test, so it's not necessarily something everyone's going to have to deal with, but they're clearly trying to find a way to cut down on freeloaders, especially as they're seeing more competition than ever from other streaming sites like HBO Max and Disney Plus and Peacock and whatever else. This is definitely an unwelcome development if you're used to borrowing a friend or family member's account, but at least there's a little bit of an upside in that people probably shouldn't be sharing your passwords so widely in the first place. Every time you do, it makes it that much easier for hackers to break into not just your Netflix account, but also any other site where you use the same password, which people do all the time. Every security expert that we talked to said this was going to help more than hurt. Netflix is definitely looking out for itself here, first and foremost. No one's disagreeing with that, but at least this test gives you an easy out. So if you are asked to enter a code, you can just ask whoever's Netflix account you're using to pass it along. You can keep binging, and that person's going to be a little bit safer because they didn't spread their password around.
Yeah, unpopular opinion. How about you just start paying for your own damn Netflix subscription? What's it now, like $15 a month? Like, I know $15 a month is not cheap. Like, I recognize that. But a whole lot of y'all riding somebody else's Netflix password is really just y'all being cheap and not being willing. Like, people who actually got money, this is what gets me. I want it, but I don't want it bad enough to pay for it, so I'll just ride off of yours. Nah, pay for your stuff. Like, it's not that, come on, man. Go ahead and do that. But see, it would be interesting for Netflix, though, because I know, you know, they certainly make the money off subscriptions and everything else. But what I think we're learning about Netflix is that people like having it, but don't necessarily want to pay for it. And I do wonder how many people, if they had to get their own password, would then ultimately, because they just got used to getting it for free. Because that's the thing, there's a whole generation, we've kind of gotten rid of that generation, but there's a whole generation, not really gotten rid of, but the new generation is different. A whole generation that was just used to not paying for stuff on the internet. And it's the hardest thing in the world to get people to pay for something that they used to get for free. Like, they've been trying to figure out how to steer around that. But what's interesting to me about it with Netflix is the only company that people talk about. It's all about sharing a Netflix password. You don't hear anybody talk about sharing Hulu passwords like that. Like, it's really just baked into Netflix in a very particular way in terms of the passwords. But just go ahead and pay for your own stuff. Like, chances are you got the money. Pay for your stuff. And if you don't have the money, may I suggest these things called books?
All right, this last one comes from education.
This is Amber Jamison from BuzzFeed News. So, on March 15, Florida officials announced that they had arrested a 17-year-old teenager and her mother for apparently hacking into the high school's student system and rigging the election to ensure the teenager won the title of Homecoming Queen of Tate High School in 2020. So last October, this teen was awarded Homecoming Queen. There's all these photos of her on the football field with a glamorous sparkling crown and a black sash over her sequin gown, declaring her as Homecoming Queen. However, the school started an investigation after they realized that there had been hundreds of fraudulent votes made for the homecoming court. One of the women arrested, the mother, Laura Rose Carroll, she's 50, she's an assistant principal at a local elementary school, and that job gave her access to the entire school district student information system. And the mother and daughter have been accused of basically accessing hundreds of high school records of Tate High School students, with the mother's account voting 246 times for the Tate High School homecoming court, which, you know, then ended up with her daughter being the winner. As part of this investigation, you know, there was 8 students and 1 teacher who all said that the 17-year-old had bragged about her ability to access confidential school records for years, had been telling friends since freshman year that she'd been looking up grades and test scores and knowing all the information about her fellow students. So after this investigation, the daughter was expelled from school. Now they face 4 charges, 3 of which are felonies, and the lawyer of the pair told us that they welcome the opportunity when the case is over to tell their side of the story.
Yo, so here's what gets me about this absurd, ridiculous, that's the whitest thing I've ever heard story. I heard about the girl getting expelled from school, Gabe, but did you hear anything about the mama being fired?
No, I didn't.
Like, at first when I'd seen, like, the headlines of this story, my thought was that it's some, like, some woman, the mother, who, like, peaked in high school and really thinks that being homecoming queen matters, you know, and all of that stuff. This woman is the assistant principal at elementary school and has been turning over access to confidential data? Like, you talk about expelling the kid. Like, I don't think the kid should be expelled from school for this. But the mom has got to be fired.
Stuff in the digital ballot box.
Yo, this is so... To be homecoming queen? Like, the thing that gets me about that is... And I think that all of us, as we have gotten older, have come to recognize this. Like, Gabe, was the SAT a big deal to you? Like, when you were in school? Like, were you doing, like, the classes and all that stuff to get ready?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you honestly, like, remember your SAT score?
I do, yeah.
Okay. Like, I remember mine kind of, but not really. Like, I think I can get you in the ballpark of it. But all those things in high school that felt so important, none of them matter. Like, nobody cares if you were the valedictorian of your high school. Like, nobody at your college cares if you were the valedictorian of your high school. Nobody cares if you were the homecoming queen. Like, all those things feel real good in the moment. But nobody actually cares about those things. They don't care about it the next year. Like, I was actually, it was funny. I was talking to Bun B about this the other day. Because he was talking about how he did powerlifting in high school. But there was one other dude that was dominating at all the meets. It was Mark Henry. Like, can you imagine you showing up to be the new powerlifting and shot and disc and all that stuff? And there's Mark Henry. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what he kept winding up doing. But he was like, yo, but I got my letter jacket. And I was like, I remember. I was like, yeah, I remember, like, the letter jacket in high school. And I think in Texas, more than anywhere else, we really care about getting a letter jacket. Like, that is a huge deal to get your varsity letter in whatever you happen to be. And they find all kinds of ways for you to get a letter. It was a giant thing. And then Bud was like, yeah, I was like, I got to college and I was surprised. Like, they were so big to us, but they weren't as big to everybody else. He was like, psh, man, the next year I was doing shows at clubs. I ain't think about it once. But for that time, it was the most important thing in the world. It's your parents' job to give you the context to let you know, no, this actually isn't that big of a deal. And an assistant principal of an elementary school out here doing this. Also, hashtag Florida. Florida Woman.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. Stimulus dropped this week for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I would imagine there were some dumb purchases already, because I had certainly seen some outlandish claims on Twitter about what people were going to buy with said stimuli checks.
Yes.
So we thought it would be a good idea to reach out to people to see what the dumbest purchase was that they had made with a big check. Not necessarily the stimulus check, as people get big checks from whatever. Our first comes from Clay in Iowa.
I've only got to go back to about a year ago. About this week, I've had my first adult job for about 6 months by that time. I've got enough rent money. A couple weeks later, the first stimulus check comes around. At the same time, my favorite bar in Iowa City closes, so I go online and try to find a little keepsake, maybe like a beer coaster or a beer mug or something. But I find the disco ball that's been hanging up in the rafters from my favorite bar. I get it. It ends up costing all the first stimulus check plus a couple hundred more bucks. So I'm pretty excited. I go pick it up with me and my buddies. We bring it back to my apartment, and it's about 15 inches too big to fit in my apartment door. So I take it to a storage unit, and it's coming up on about a year since I've had a 10x10 storage unit for just my disco ball.
What? You can't even get it in your house? Wow. Wow. Also, you were going to put a disco ball in your house? And all that tells me is you, sir, are single.
That is the most single guy purchase ever.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that's the singlest. And I don't mean like not married. I mean like girls don't be coming over to your crib.
Or it's one of those things where you buy it and you do it without telling your partner. And then you get it home and they're like, well, that's going in the garage.
No, that's not even coming in the house. That's going on eBay. Wow. I can't imagine. Like, here's my thing about it. The place was closing down. Who were you negotiating against? Like, I just don't see how you couldn't get that for $40.
And storage containers aren't exactly cheap. They're usually like $100
no!
a month.
No! You got a bill. You went up there and paid for a bill.
You know what? A year of storage container renting may actually equate the cost of a single stimulus check.
Not your finest hour, Clay. At least I'm glad you know it was stupid. Like, that's the best part, is that we told people to tell us about stupid things they've done, so I don't have to be nice to y'all about, like, how I feel about these stupid things that you have done.
It's a safe space. This next one comes from JD in Missouri.
The dumbest thing I ever bought with a big check was a car. So back in around 2010, I got a, you know, a refund check from college. So I'm like, I'm going to be in this town, so I'm going to get me a ride. So I'm back home, searching the internet, looking for cars, and I found a good price, $2,200 for a Trailblazer. So I went on there and sent the money, Western Union. The car supposed to be delivered about a week later. I'm waiting on the delivery, sitting there waiting. Didn't consult with nobody, that's what you're thinking. I didn't consult, not a soul about this. I just went on and did it because I had my own car. And the day it was supposed to be delivered, the person actually hit me up like, hey, the truck stopped. We need another $700. And at that point, I knew I got. And I had to tell my whole family about it because it was a big check. They knew I had the money. I knew I was supposed to be getting the car. 12 years later, lived that down. They still make fun of me at least twice a year about that. But it was the last time I lost money on a big transaction.
JD always got something, don't he? JD always got something. I tell you this, though. The warning sign was, send me the money, Western Union.
Yeah.
Like we don't conduct business over Western Union, right? You do people favors via Western Union. You pay off debts via Western Union. You do not buy a car via Western Union. This actually reminds me of my favorite purchase I ever made when I got a big check. I'm really going safe space with y'all, telling y'all this story. Okay. So it was the year 2016, I want to say, somewhere around there. And I had just gotten put in my tax paperwork with my guy and all of this stuff. All right. And so, just so you know, I give Uncle Sam a lot of money. All right. They be like, I ain't turned Republican. And that really is a testament to the strength of my character. Because it's crossed my mind a couple of times. That first time after I started doing TV and I got one of them checks, I looked at all them deductions. I was like, yo, man, like, I don't even really feel like wow, okay. Anyway, so I'm on the phone with my tax man, minding my own business. And he hits me and says, all right, well, we're done with your taxes. And basically every year, the way we do it, I get zero after I, like, you know, do all the allowances, except, you know, all that stuff. But we try to set it up to where at the end of the year, I don't owe them. They don't owe me. Like the year before that, I had gotten a refund of like $500. Like, that's how we try to do it. Out of nowhere, man, my tax man said to me, again, this is new, like, relatively new on my journey. He's like, okay, cool. He just said, matter of fact, we just got through doing your taxes and looks like you're going to get a refund of $89,000. I said, did you say 89 or 8 or 9? He says, 89. Man, I got that check. I would have got a BMW. That's what I would have got the BMW. But I had that M4. That was why, because I ain't got that check. And to be honest, it wasn't the smartest purchase I ever made, because I bought it for 72. A year later, I took it back to the dealership for 50. So it wasn't like it was the wisest purchase, but I got my $20,000 worth of that in-between year, boy. Woo, man. I remember I drove that car up to Atlanta so my mama could ride, because she's like, oh, I learned that my mama likes cars. She's like, yeah, I want to see the car. I want to see the car. So I drove up to Atlanta. Man, I'm in the car with my mama on back roads doing like 75 and a 30. And she ain't complaining once. It's a different 75, though. I'm just showing how that thing swang, how that thing bang, how that thing go. Oh, man, that was great. Anyway, my point is, if somebody had asked me to buy that car via Western Union, I probably wouldn't have.
A lot of times for people, like, a car buying is like a first big purchase that they've ever had to make. I knew a guy in college who tried to buy a new car with his parents' credit card.
Oh, I ain't gonna lie. I tried to buy that card on my credit card. I wanted the points. I wanted the points. Like, I was gonna pay. Like, I clearly, like, dog, can you imagine somebody out of nowhere telling you 89? I really thought he said 8 or 9, because it never dawned on me it could possibly be 89.
Feels like free money too, right?
Whew. Woo! Yeah, even though it's yours. It's money I didn't expect. That's the best way to put it.
All right, so our last dumb purchase with free money comes from Tarika in Michigan.
Back in the day, when I was in college, you know, I used to get refund checks, right? I was, a college athlete, so I had a little scholarship money, so occasionally I would get a refund check. So I remember back in Raleigh, I got a refund check for like 3 racks, right? You couldn't tell me nothing because I had 3 racks. So I got like some school gear, school shirts and stuff, paid a couple bills. I didn't stay on campus, so I paid my rent up for a couple months. I was good. Now, instead of doing the responsible thing, like making sure that everything else, you know, your car or, you know, your parents or anything like that that you needed to take care of, instead of doing that, I decided I wanted to go ball out with my friends. So we hit up this club. I can't remember the name of the club to save my life, but it was on Glenwood Avenue. And I'm in the club balling out, right? Like, I didn't bought the VIP section. I didn't want a little booth. I wanted the big booth, like the 350 booth or whatever. And it was white with the white couch and the carpet and the bottle service. I didn't bought like 3 bottles of Moet. You know, Moet, like $150 a bottle. I'm just out here acting crazy. On top of that, I'm still buying regular drinks. And I was drinking like Hennessy and Patron at the time. So each drink is like $10, $12. I'm just acting a whole fool, right? By the time I leave the club, I done probably spent a good $700 in the club. How about I go outside because I'm driving this 1993 Grand Prix and my damn car will start. Transmission went out on my whip. I done spent all my money in a club. I don't even got like $50 to get a tow truck right now because I don't even know what I did with all this money that I thought I brought. So I done had to ask my homegirl, can I borrow like $50 to call the tow truck? I'm too drunk to be embarrassed. I don't know what is going on right now. I'm upset that my car didn't start. But at the same time, I'm too drunk to really realize the situation that I'm in right now. So, needless to say, I never got my transmission fixed on my car. They ended up just junking it or whatnot. But I promise I'll never in my life just go to the club and just spend stupid money for no reason on, like, drinks and a seat.
All right, so fun fact here. What, Tarika has worked on the show for a very long time. I did not realize that she went to college in Raleigh. I kicked it on Glenwood South. I know the life that she was out there living, like the Hennessy and Patron era. Okay, I see how you was getting down. I see you. And I just had to think that it all came crashing down at once. Right, the transmission don't work, like right here. And the thing that I had to feel bad for was if her transmission just went out like that, she knew she had a car where she should have been stacking that money and holding it a little bit tighter, right? Like, the transmission don't go out on your car when everything else is OBKB. That's not really this. I'll tell you this, though, that refund check game, because I ain't even know about refund. Like, I grew up in college, basically, because my parents were professors, but I didn't know much about, like, the financial aid game and any of that. So I had no idea of the notion of the refund check. I didn't know about that until I got to school. I'll never forget, man. One of my homeboys, he had gotten a job at the movie theater at Lenox. Got a job at the movie theater at Lenox. And he had been going up there, you know, getting a little bread. You know, wasn't like we were studying, you know. So he was just going up there, making that happen. He broke his foot one day because something happened and they got bored and they were kicking a closet and they were trying to like kick the door in the closet. And I remember I had taken him to the hospital the next day because I wasn't on campus that night and he had broken his foot. So he's got this broken foot, but he's still going to his job or whatever. And then that refund check came in. I think that refund check might have been like $2,500. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember what he did in order. He got that $2,500. He quit his job, bought an ounce of weed, and he ordered a brand new stereo. Those 3 steps in succession. Like, he had been so broke before that like, he'd go check his balance. And, like, I think his bank would let you take out 10. 10 was the smallest increment that you could take out of the ATM at his bank. Because there used to be a bank that let you take out 5. And, you know, when you broke in college, like, the difference between taking out 10 and taking out 5 could be significant. He would go, and we just check. He'd be like, oh, still at $2. Well, still at $2. And then he go back and his dad had put some money in, up to $22. You know, like we was living the for real struggling in college existence. Man, he got that check. He was like, nah, man, we about to be living, man. He was broke again in like maybe a month.
How did he pay the rent?
It was college. He's in the door.
The way that my financial aid experience worked was my refund checks were to pay expenses like rent and groceries and stuff.
No, so, right. So what he was doing with his refund was it was extra loan money. And so the room and board and tuition had already been paid. And then these are like living accommodations. But like the meal plan has already been paid for. Yeah. So these, in theory, you got food. Like all of that is straight. And again, we just been broke. So he got that refund check and he didn't blow it all. But the first move was, how do I blow some of this money? How do I do that right then? And then, yeah, it was an ounce of weed, it was brand new stereo, and he quit the job at the movie theater. In retrospect, it probably would have worked out okay if he had kept the job at the movie theater. It was just hard to get there because, again, my man had a broken foot. College, man, learning how to make good decisions typically involves starting off making some bad ones. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. Gabe Bassane and Tony Collider, you handle everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Also, thank you to CarMax. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Jake Coyle of the Associated Press. Check out his story on the McKinsey Report on Black-led projects being underfunded in Hollywood. Thanks to Brian Barrett of Wired. Check out his story on Netflix cracking down on password sharing. And thanks to Amber Jameson of BuzzFeed. Check out her story on a Florida teen and her mom getting arrested for rigging the homecoming queen vote. Yes, it's that ridiculous. All right, remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you're a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.